From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Since the Columbine school shooting 19 years ago, tens of thousands of other students have cringed in corners or cowered in closets during other shootings or drills. What traumas do they carry? How should parents talk to them? After last week's fatal shooting in St. Mary's County, the Mental Health Association of Maryland posted talking points to help that communication. Senior Program Officer Leanne Browning-McNee.
As much as media brings everything closer, we still sometimes feel a little safer when things happen half a country away or multiple states away. But when you start talking about what's happening in our own state and in our own backyard, we really wanted to make sure that parents were prepared for that.
Then clinical professor Gail Cicero on the skills school counselors need. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. The Columbine High School massacre in Colorado, where two shooters gunned down 13 people, took place 19 years ago. There have been dozens more school shootings since then. Last month, Parkland, Florida's shooting left 17 dead, and the most recent fatality is Jaylynn Willey, who was shot last Tuesday just before classes began at Great Mills High School in Southern Maryland. She died 2 days later. Scores have died from gun violence, and more than 187,000 students have been exposed to gun violence at school since Columbine, according to a new analysis by the Washington Post. What are the effects of experiencing that trauma? How do parents, teachers, and counselors comfort and guide students and their families after tragedies take place and take lives? Later in the show, we'll hear from a professor at Loyola University, Maryland, who's redesigned a course to better address the skills school counselors need today. Joining us now is Leanne Browning-McNee, Communications and Chief Program Officer at the Mental Health Association of Maryland. The Mental Health Association recently published a talking points list available online, which helps parents address their children's questions and concerns following school shootings. Full disclosure, I'm on the board of the Mental Health Association of Maryland. Welcome to On the Record, Leanne.
Thank you, Sheila.
What is the role of the Mental Health Association of Maryland?
You know, the Mental Health Association of Maryland is a nonprofit organization, and we focus primarily on education, advocacy, and services oversight. And what's really cool is we do that for people of all ages, so from young kids to older adults, and across all stages of the mental health and mental illness spectrum. So whether we're talking about prevention, which we might be as we talk about some of those talking points you referenced, or early intervention or treatment and recovery, the Mental Health Association kind of covers all of that.
And the document you posted is called Talking to Your Child About the St. Mary School Shooting. What are the talking points?
You know, there are lots of them, and there are lots of resources. If you go to the website at www.mhamd.org, you can see the full list. But what we really focus on are a few things. One is this is a really hard conversation for a lot of parents to have. And so one of the first things that we advise parents to do is kind of work it through yourself. Go through your own process and be sure before you start the conversation with your kid, if you have the luxury of time, to kind of figure out what it is you want to say. What is it that you want your child to take away from the conversation? And that's going to be different depending on the age of the child.
Should parents be waiting for some sign that their child wants to discuss this?
Depends on the age. So one of the things that most mental health experts say is children around the ages of 7 or 8, younger than 7 or 8, should pretty much be shielded as best we can in today's media environment from the story. So really in those cases, I kind of wait to see if the child says anything, comments on anything. You know, if you're watching television or listening to the radio and you hear a story come in, you might feel the need to address it at that point. But if it's younger than a kid younger than 7 or 8, I'd really shield them as best you can. As the kids get older, I think you want to go ahead and bring it up because they're going to hear about it somewhere. I'm a mom. I have a son in middle school, just started middle school this year. And so when he got home from school that evening, I said, "Did you hear about anything in the news today?" And just kind of opened it up. I didn't sit down and say, "Hey, did you hear this really bad, horrible thing that happened? Let's talk about it." I kind of just gave him the opening so that I could feel first, what did he know? What did he not know? And then kind of follow the conversation from there.
And why did you post talking points now?
Well, obviously right now, because it happened in our own home. It's in our state. It's in Maryland. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, I mean, as a mental health association in Maryland, it was our responsibility to do it. But also, you know, I think so often, as much as media brings everything closer, we still sometimes feel a little safer when things happen, you know, half a country away or multiple states away. But when you start talking about what's happening in our own state and in our own backyard, we really wanted to make sure that parents were prepared for that, because we knew it was going to get a lot of media coverage in the state. We knew that, you know, it would be talked about at schools throughout the state. And we really wanted to do everything we could do to help parents and to help educators be able to have these conversations with their kids.
So even if a child isn't at a school where a shooting occurred, there's kind of a what-if element?
There's a big what-if element. Again, depending on the child's experience and their age, everything from, you know, a little bit of that idea of, could this happen to me? Could this happen in my school? Could this happen to my mom or my dad or my friends or other people that I care about? You know, and if, especially when you hear it then connected to Maryland, where you know you live, it just feels really close and potentially really uncomfortable for kids who are already maybe experiencing anxiety in their lives or have already had trauma in their lives. You know, hearing news like this can really amp it up. You know, it can make the anxiety greater. It can, you know, kind of trigger memories, you know, and people will be grieving.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Leanne Browning-McNee, Communications and Chief Program Officer at the Mental Health Association of Maryland, about how to talk with children about their fears or concerns after school shootings. Why do you think, though, that parents need a guide? What are the difficulties of a conversation like this?
I think our own reactions are often one of the biggest difficulties of all. And this is a hard conversation. We may be vulnerable ourselves. We may feel really scared. We may have some of those what ifs. What if that was my child? What if that was my child's school? What if that was somebody that I cared about or loved? So there's a lot of that. Some of us may be, quite frankly, downright angry that 19 years after Columbine, we're still having to have these difficult conversations with their kids. There's just so many emotions that we as parents may have, whether it's our political beliefs or just our general emotions and fears, that sometimes we have to kind of get out of our own heads and process through that before we can have the conversation with our kids. And it's important that our kids get a chance to process what they've heard, to process it in a safe environment. And also because we want to make sure that what we're communicating with our kids reflects our values, reflects the values that we're trying to teach our kids, that we're trying to instill in our own kids.
What training or information does the Mental Health Association of Maryland provide for other adults and those who work with children?
You know, we do lots of different things. One of the things that we have is Children's Mental Health Matters, which is a year-round campaign that really comes together in May with Children's Mental Health Awareness Week, the first week in May. And if you go to the website, you'll see lots of events. We have more, I think it's about 400 school champions. So that means 400 schools around the state of Maryland who are doing events during this week to help parents and educators recognize signs and symptoms, know where they can find resources, and even figure out sometimes how to navigate the system. We also have a program called Mental Health First Aid, and we have trained more than 4,000 teachers, school administrators, community partners around the state in, you know, recognizing and understanding mental health problems that may impact youth, and actually really understanding what to do and how to connect them to resources.
By the way, we will link at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. We'll link to the Mental Health Association of Maryland's website. Tell us more about Mental Health First Aid.
So Mental Health First Aid is largely just what it sounds like. Just like we're used to CPR and first aid for other types of physical illnesses or injuries, mental health first aid really focuses on helping someone who may have a mental health problem or be in a mental health crisis. It's a program that is funded here in Maryland primarily by the Department of Health, the Behavioral Health Administration. And we've trained more than 28,000 Marylanders in the program. And our evaluation shows us that people are really using the skills that they learn, those skills of recognizing the signs that someone may have a problem, being able to reach out and connect with them. And you learn some do's and some don'ts, you know, things you don't want to say, things you should say in those situations. And then being able to connect them, bridge them to a resource. Because as lay people, just like with first aid, you know, I may know CPR, but I'm not doing heart surgery. And with mental health first aid, we're really trying to kind of mirror that, you know, helping people find those. What are those first steps? What are those first things that you do that you can reach out and then bridge to somebody else who may be that professional that has the skill set that someone needs?
A minute ago, you used the phrase do's and don'ts. In this situation of families, parents talking with children after a shooting, is there something that parents should really be cautious not to do? Is there a don't that you would flag for them?
You know, I think the biggest don't that I would flag is don't let other people tell you how to talk to your own child. I think read the information, absorb all the information that you can, but at the end of the day, parents know their kids best. And I really think that being able to know what to say to your child, how to interact with your child, you know, trust your gut. That's the biggest do. And the biggest don't is probably don't let people talk you out of doing that.
A few minutes ago, you were talking about the what ifs. If a child asks, could this happen where I am, what can a parent say?
If a child asks, could this happen where I am, I think in some ways that's one of the biggest questions we as parents may dread in that situation, because it's tough to answer. You don't want to give a promise that's like, no, that could never happen, especially when we know that kids are practicing. They're going through drills at schools every day. And so we want to make sure that they're understanding that those are real and they need to pay attention to them. I think, you know, one of the things that we can do is say, honestly, it could happen anywhere. However, really stress what the school is doing to keep the child safe. That's why the doors are locked at your school and people have to be buzzed in. That's why you have a school safety officer or a school resource officer, if that's somebody that's present in your class. That's why you do the drills, so that if something scary does happen, you're prepared and you know what to do in those situations. So really reminding the child, what does the school, what do the people in the school do to protect them and to keep them safe, so that you're giving an honest answer, but you're also giving some context for that answer.
Leanne, thank you.
Thank you.
Leanne Browning-McNee is Communications and Chief Program Officer at the Mental Health Association of Maryland, on whose board I serve. She's been describing a guide for parents to talk with children about fears and concerns about school shootings. After the break here on The Record, we'll ask a Loyola professor about her new course designed to give counselors skills to deal with school crisis and trauma. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking about what happens when students are exposed to gun violence in school. The Washington Post reports that more than 187,000 students fall into that category, the cumulative number since the Columbine shooting in 1999. Earlier, Leanne Browning-McNee from the Mental Health Association of Maryland offered suggestions about how parents can talk to their children in the aftermath of such events. School counselors become even more invaluable during tragedies like these. Our next guest has redesigned curriculum to address the evolving skills counselors need to deal with traumatic situations. Dr. Gail Cicero is a clinical professor at Loyola University, Maryland. Before that, she was director of student services at Anne Arundel County, where she worked for 30 years. Welcome to On the Record, Dr. Cicero.
Thank you.
Tell me about the curriculum that you're teaching at Loyola.
So at Loyola University, we have a specific program, a master's program, to prepare school counselors. And within that program, one of our elective courses is called Helping Students Manage Crisis. And that's actually the course that we have redesigned in the past year to really meet some of the needs of students who are experiencing trauma, whether it be an in-school trauma, catastrophic trauma, or some trauma in their life.
So you've redesigned this quite recently. Why?
We did. Well, the course has been around for about 10 years, and what we found over time is that our students who are graduating and working in the capacity of school counselors, they need a specific skill set to help children with trauma in different ways. For example, there's been so many things around natural disaster. And again, that wasn't a typical part of our curriculum, wasn't about teaching school counselors to really respond to that. And yet they're sitting in schools and community folks come to them for support after those kind of natural disasters, like a hurricane or some other huge event. And also the increase in the violent episodes in the news, those things that happen in society also impact schools, even when they don't happen inside of the schoolhouse. So when we hear about workplace shootings that occur in a community or a shooting in a large department store, our children are greatly affected by that. And they bring that into school and rely on counselors for support and help in those areas.
So how do you work out a curriculum that addresses that gives counselors the skills they need?
Well, the first thing that we do is teach some common language around trauma and what it is. We teach specifically around developmental pieces. In other words, how is it that a 5-year-old might express that different than a 12-year-old or a high schooler? And that's important because school counselors are actually trained to work K through 12. So they work with, you know, children as young as 5 and actually preschool in schools that have preschool. And they're working with students through high school. The other piece that we do is we use a book that has the lived stories of folks from Katrina. It's actually stories from folks that experienced that. And we read those stories to really learn about and begin to teach the compassion and empathy around what that must be like for a person to experience a trauma of that magnitude. We also study a novel about school shooting, again, so we can talk about how is it that staff are impacted and parents and the school principal and children, because you're going to be called to understand that. And the first step in that is to try to step into that experience so you can empathize. After we talk about all of that, we move into some real techniques. So we do teach some of the strategies from psychological first aid. It's a published document that we use in the course. We also look at some of the evidence-based practices. There are some out there that are designed to work with children and teens following a trauma. So we actually teach some skills after we teach that language piece and get into the lived experiences.
How do these techniques differ if someone is counseling children, young children, versus teenagers? Mm-hmm.
In part, vocabulary is a big part, right? The kind of words that we use, for example, when we're explaining something to a 5-year-old versus a 17-year-old, just paying attention to the language and the words are important. And some of the goals with young children differ slightly in that our first concern with them is to create a sense of safety and security. And not that we don't do that with older children or teenagers as well, but in particular with children, they often don't have the words to express what they're feeling. So when something terrible happens or traumatic, we tend to see behaviors, maybe a tantrum or meltdowns or some other sort of behavioral sign. And so when we work with our aspiring school counselors, we need to teach them to look for those behaviors, create a sense of safety, and then actually help young people to put feeling words to what they're feeling. They don't come with that vocabulary very young, so that we can work through that. On the flip side, when we're working with middle and high schoolers, we would tend to work with those issues maybe in a more abstract way.
How do students react to this?
Students react, of course, in a variety of ways. Like grief, there isn't a set normal, but there's no question that responding to traumatic events can interfere with a number of things like sleep, nutrition, and then that, of course, impacts your ability to learn, emotional regulation, high emotions. Sometimes children shut down. Sometimes children stop attending. Sometimes children act out. And sometimes all of the above. So there really isn't one sign or symptom that's characteristics of all children. I think it's also important to note that when we're working with children and when we're teaching counselors to work with children, we also have to know our children. This is where school counselors come in. They are the hub of the school. They know their children. They work with them for many years. And someone with a prior trauma history or perhaps a significant mental health disability over time may have a different reaction than someone without those factors. And we have to be aware of those circumstances as well.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dr. Gail Cicero, a clinical professor at Loyola University, Maryland, about her course, Helping Students Manage Crisis. It teaches counselors updated skills for use during traumatic events. And I understand the course has been updated to respond to Maryland law.
It has. So Lauren's law passed April of 2017 for Maryland, and that law really states that school counselors, all school counselors, must have 15 contact hours of training in very specific areas. And those areas center on depression, on trauma, on substance use, on violence, and all of the areas of that law we cover in this particular course because they're so pertinent to trauma in general.
It's called Lauren's Law because of a girl who committed suicide in Prince George's County.
Prince George's County, yes.
Lauren Santiago. You spent 30 years in the Anne Arundel County school system. How has that experience played into this course design?
I think in a broad way, most helpful is that I began my career in the classroom and worked through a variety of positions until I got to the central office. So I understand how schools work from the classroom level to the top. And I think that gives me credibility with my students because I understand the impact on teachers. And then on the other end, I also understand the policy and executive functions for my central office work. I know the possibilities on that end. So I think that credibility and being able to tell stories that are real really help my students to connect and view me as credible. I also think that from a layman's angle, having been a school employee, a school counselor, and a teacher, I know what it looks like in the school when children who've experienced trauma come in and try to take on the task of learning. And I understand it from the side of an employee who wants children to learn and to behave appropriately and do things equally, how frustrating that can be. And so I think having that perspective makes it particularly helpful for me.
To pivot a bit, the American School Counselor Association recommends a ratio of 250 students to each counselor. The national average is almost double that, about 482 to 1 in the most recent year for which there's data. Maryland's average is 369 students to each counselor. In your view, would more counselors in schools actually prevent or reduce some of the violence in academic settings?
I absolutely believe that's the biggest part of the solution. There's no question that I'm biased about the important role school counselors play, but they come with unique training and they're part of the school and they contribute to the climate and they're known to parents and to staff and to students. And for that reason, they can have among the greatest impact. And I'm glad you brought in the prevention piece because we talk a lot about that in this class as well. The answer to this problem isn't how we respond over and over again. I think we have to explore more deeply what it is we need to do as a society and schools and school counselors to prevent this. I think that at the elementary level is where we need to have our smallest ratio of counselor to students. When they're in their K to 5 program, they need access to a counselor, and we need to have small ratios for that, who know them and can make sure that they're connected to school and peers well before we ever send them on to secondary school. Little children are very open. They don't quite carry the baggage that we do the older we get. They haven't quite put up the walls quite as hard as mine or yours. It's the place to intervene. And it's the place that we don't staff enough, because the things that happen, the big events, happen at the high school level. And so we run and we're maybe add a high school counselor. But the answer, we have to fix it, and we have to work with it, I think, at the elementary level. And there's no question that school counselors at that level have the skills, if they had the caseloads to deliver the services, could make, I think, a huge dent in the problem that our youth are facing and the acting out in the middle and high school years.
A lot to think about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Gail Cicero, a clinical professor at Loyola University, Maryland, about her course, Helping Students Manage Crisis. It teaches counselors updated skills for use during and after traumatic events. Earlier, we spoke with Leanne Browning-McNee, Communications and Chief Program Officer at the Mental Health Association of Maryland. We have links to the talking points for parents she spoke about at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.